On this edition of Celebrating Science, Nobel laureate Gerard Toft on science fiction and reality. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, non-profit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation.
Science Fiction versus Reality with Gerard Toft from Utrecht University in the Netherlands. Professor Toft was raised in the Netherlands, where he studied theoretical physics at the University of Utrecht, completing his thesis work in 1972 under the supervision of Martin Veltman. For 2 years, he continued his research in the European Particle Physics Community at CERN in Geneva. After lectureships in the United States at Harvard and Stanford, he was appointed full professor in 1976. Among his many honors, Professor Toft and Veltman were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1999 for elucidating the quantum structure of electroweak interactions in physics, which refers to their joint work in 1972. His research has brought important new insights showing how to use quantized fields to describe subatomic particles. Recently, he has turned his interest to the quantum aspects of gravitation and black holes. Professor Toft is also a member of Perimeter Institute's Scientific Advisory Committee, our highest oversight body of leading international researchers who steer much of the activity at the Institute. He also supports our educational outreach activities and considers the communication of fundamental science to be one of his most important duties. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Waterloo, to Canada, and to Perimeter Institute, Professor Gerard Toft.
Thank you very much, John, for your very kind introduction. It's for the first time here that I've been visiting the Perimeter Institute, and I'm very impressed with this enormously beautiful site, all just for purely theoretical physics, which is the main topic of my research. So this is really a very important place for me to be. So in ordinary life, I'm a theoretical physicist, and I ask questions about theoretical physics and try to solve problems that we are encountering there. But every now and then, I'm asking different kinds of questions. Questions about what will modern science bring us in the future, and what are the kind of things that will never be in reach of modern science in the future. Of course, to get answers on such questions, you can read science fiction novels. But those science fiction novels are not very accurate, and I think as a theoretical physicist, I'm in a position to give better answers. At least that is what I believe myself. And so I would like to share with you some of those answers I've come up with. The questions I'm asking are numerous, like will we solve problems concerning energy, poverty, climate change? How far will science be able to prolong human lifetimes? How will society change under the influence of scientific discoveries? Will humanity indeed be able to conquer space? And how far will we get in outer space? Will we outlive planet Earth? Eventually, planet Earth will be swallowed by the sun in billions of years from now. So what can modern science say, but now not doing science fiction, but using the science that we know and the science that we think we understand? And then you see that there are possibilities, but also limitations. I've written all this down in a book, which unfortunately is not yet available here. It's not yet ready, but it will be ready in 1 or 2 months' time, and there you can read much more about these questions. Today's talk will only be a small excerpt of the issues which are discussed in that book. I'll talk about atoms, about nanoscience, and about computers, in particular intelligent computers, about robots, and eventually I'll go to conquer outer space, and you'll see and perhaps laugh about the way in which I try to conquer outer space. So let me first begin with questions here on Earth. How will science proceed and how science help us apply new discoveries to change our lives. My topic in science is theoretical physics, but that needs input, continuously input, from experimental observations and discoveries. A marvelous new laboratory in near Geneva called CERN is building a new machine which will be ready within this year, and they'll start new investigations about elementary particles. These are huge, big laboratories. And in these enormously big laboratories, people will search the very tiniest insides of an atom, an atomic nucleus. If you look at this picture, if you look very well, you see a man standing in front, hardly visible. This just shows how gigantically big these laboratories and these machines are, with which we try to understand the deepest inside of the atom. So, yes, we'll like to study things such as the atomic nucleus. Those machines are about the insides of the atomic nucleus, and the quarks, which are parts of the subatomic particles, and so on and so forth. I can recommend you to read a bit about this, because this is a fascinating science. But actually, for the questions I'm asking now, it's not going to do very much. It's going to do much more to think of studying the atom. The atom is much better understood scientifically, and it hasn't been used as much as it could be used in the near future to change, indeed, our lives. And I'll explain to you how that can be done. So it's really the atom on which I focus. And to make my point, I want to go back to 1959, when Richard Feynman here gave a marvelous talk. The talk he gave was a very visionary idea about what the future would look like. And the title of the talk was, "There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom." You can hear Feynman say it, if you know what he was like at the time. And what he meant with that, at the bottom, he meant at the very tiniest scales you can make in experimental science, at the atomic scale. He said, imagine, just imagine, that humanity would be able to manipulate atom by atom everything we are making. Imagine that we could make computer memories which have the size of a few atoms rather than the sizes they have now. Today they are very small. On a very tiny memory key which many of us have in their pockets, already you can put several gigabytes of information. But that is nothing compared to what is theoretically possible, according to Feynman. So you can do much, much more. For instance, this is a microscopic picture of a computer chip. But small as it is much, much larger than the atoms of which it is made. So imagine that you can make a similar gadget like this, but now those parts are really parts made out of singular atoms. Rather naively, people at the time thought, maybe you can make very tiny little hands and have these hands be controlled somehow that you can pick single atoms and put them wherever you want them. That was the idea. And, well, the idea is to make devices of atomic size. So here you see what engineers are thinking about. The topic, by the way, is called nanotechnology. Nano standing for nanometer, which is a typical size of this object, a couple of atoms big. And you can see downstairs that you can make wheels and bearings out of that. You can make complicated connections or machines that can move and twiddle around. And just imagine what you would be able to do technically with such devices. Compared to that, the devices, the tools we use today, seem to be stemming straight from the Stone Age. And I think, indeed, a few hundred years from now, they'll say that this laptop here is a Stone Age device, which they will excavate somewhere from deep underground, whereas the real devices they'll be using are just made of atoms like that. Now, this is scientifically not a crazy idea, and my belief is that in the not-so-distant future, it will be possible to make things like this. And people are on their way of trying to fabricate objects. However, today it still is extremely expensive and difficult to make them the question is, how can you make them in large quantities very cheaply? And they'll transform our lives even more. So today you might think that we are in the information era. Well, you haven't seen anything yet. You can do much, much more with these tiny devices. Here you see atoms of life, a protein molecule, and the molecules that make our DNA, which are the essential elements of any biological organism which control the way the organism functions, the way the organism grows, called DNA. And DNA today can be studied microscopically and understood, but it's still extremely difficult. I'm waiting for machines that can read DNA just as easily as we read today our hard disk of floppy drives or whatever in our computers. That hasn't happened yet. There's now competition going on. Who will devise the first machine that can read the human genome for less than $1,000 per person? Well, that, of course, is still something for the future. Here you see the human genome has been read and basically be understood a couple of years ago, but this still costs millions of dollars. But my belief is, in the more distant future, it will be as easy to read as our floppy disks or whatever. And so you just put your finger in a machine and out comes, like if you put it in a scanner, out comes a file with your genome. Now imagine that you can read them that easily. The next step will be how to write a genome. Because, of course, if you can read, we want to write in the distant future. So what you want to do is make some changes there. Just program in your computer whatever you want the changes to be. And there'll be an enormous, big and complicated software package that will calculate what the genome should be like to realize what you really want. Suppose you want organisms like plants that do something very special. A plant that for instance, grows little cherries full of gasoline so that you can put them straight into your car. Or plants that generate electricity directly, so they have little plugs on them and you get the electricity out. So you have to write that in the genome of the plant. Some way or other, I think these things, I'm simplifying things a little bit, but I think those things are in principle technically possible. That, at least, is not fundamentally outright at odds with what we know about science. This is conceivable, those things. And some science fiction authors think about the same things, but not so very many. So I think there's quite a number of possibilities here concerning food, concerning the supply of water. Think of plants just filtering salty water and leaving fresh water at the other side. Energy, of course, energy consumption. I think you have to grow crops to generate energy. It's already done today, but not very efficiently. I think it can, in principle, be done much better. And finally, of course, the subject of space colonization. Imagine people who want to go to the moon or to Mars or God knows where. They might want to have some changes in the genome because life conditions are so different from Earth. One of the most marvelous molecular structures that I'm going to talk about later will be made of pure carbon. These are carbon atoms in a very fundamental rectangular array. We call it a lattice. And this substance here is called graphene, which is a single layer of carbon atoms. But you get something even more remarkable if you roll it up. You roll it up like this. And then what you get is a tube. And this tube is typically of a diameter of a nanometer or so. And therefore, these things are called nanotubes. They're exclusively made of carbon atoms. They have very spectacular properties. The most spectacular properties is its strength. The Young modulus, which is the extent to which you can stretch or squeeze these things, is 5 times better than that of steel. But other properties are even much more remarkable, and I'll dwell more on that in a minute or so. They're also semiconducting or metallic. It depends on exactly how you roll up that sheet. I rolled it up because you roll it up in different directions. You get different chirality, and then its properties will also change. All this will be applied at full length in the future. We can make those things right now, but only at microscopic levels. You can't make very long threads of these nanotubes, not yet, but my belief is that will come fairly soon. So the information era has only just started. You've seen nothing yet. There's much more coming, both in computer software and computer hardware. So they can become gigantically much more faster and much better than today. The testimony of that is that every living cell in our body has enormous amount of memory, like the disk in your computer, roughly speaking, the hard disk of today's computer. So we have hard disks in every cell of our body. So if nature can make it, why should humans not be able to copy that some way or other? So you can imagine how much information you get in there. This picture here is an illustration of the advances that are made scientifically. Every 5 years or so, you see a factor of nearly 10 of increase in the number of memory units on a single chip. You see it rose from 1,000 to 10,000, 100,000 to a billion, and soon that will be more than that. So, and you see this is practically a straight line. So it seems as if this line will continue forever. Well, that is scientifically not possible. It won't continue forever. And actually, right now, it's flattening off a little bit because we reached a difficult barrier, the optical barrier, which means that you can't use optical machines anymore if you want to really improve much. But you can use your brains and you can try to be smart and use other methods to make tinier memory devices. And I'm sure that will happen one day or other. And this line eventually can continue to rise. In fact, if you ask yourself, where will this stop? Well, this can only stop, and this has to stop, when you reach atomic sizes. You can't put more memory elements on a device than one, say, per atom or so, or one per molecule. Then you really reach an important barrier, which is very difficult to break. You might have to go downwards in the third dimension and still use three-dimensional arrays of memory, and then this line can again continue quite a bit. But eventually, after 60 or so years, this line will have to flatten off. And sometimes I speculate what will happen then. Apparently, humanity will then have to get used to the idea that we will not be able to make smarter devices than before. Well, as I just illustrated, that won't happen for quite some time. So what about intelligence of computers? Well, this is a subject that you often read about in science fiction, but often in a negative sense. They say, well, computers can never be as intelligent as humans. And there are certain tasks that computers can never do because humans can do them better. I don't believe a thing of that. And that's where I also have a different opinion than many of my colleagues who say you can never make an intelligent computer. I don't believe that. I think you need much better software than you have today. You need a lot of basic thinking about it. But there's no fundamental obstacle against making a computer as intelligent as people or better. Think of all devices that man has made to improve and make our life easier. Think of any device that can dig. Well, we can dig with our hands, but if we make a machine that can dig much, much deeper and faster than we can. We can run very fast, but we can make devices that go on rails or on wheels, which are much faster than that. Even devices that fly, whereas we can't fly. Birds can fly, but the devices we can make that can fly are much bigger than birds. So as soon as we succeed in making something artificial, it can do an order of magnitude better than humans. So I think the same will happen with intelligence. If we succeed in making intelligent computers, they'll be much more intelligent than we are. So for instance, today it's practically impossible to let a computer read a handwritten text. If you give it a handwritten text, computers just go flat and explode or something. They can't read a thing because people write so in such a sloppy way. We humans can read the text. Well, I think a good intelligent computer has an enormous big memory file of all possible ways in which people can maltreat letters and how the hand movements make letters look different from what it is supposed to look. They understand that much better than humans do, with as a consequence that if you can't read a note at all anymore, you feed it in your computer and your computer will figure out what the note was supposed to read, because it is more intelligent than humans and not less. I think that is possible with science that does not yet exist today. Well, then what about robots? And you read a lot about that in science fiction. Automatically moving machines, they may have their computers in a little box on top of their shoulders, but that is crazy. Why should they have their brains there? It's probably easier to have them remotely controlled by computers, which can then be as big as you want. Or maybe they do carry their own brains on their heads or anywhere else. You can think of all those things. There's absolutely no reason for robots to look like humans. I think that is silly. Only science fiction authors can think of that sort of thing. So we make them look totally different, and we make them to do very specialized tasks. They can also be made very small and universally adaptable. There's one little catch. Now again, I have to say something out of science. If you make a robot very small, then the one thing that they can't do is see very well. What's that? Well, if you make a robot very small, their eyes will also be very small, like the eyes of a fly. Now, a fly has very bad eyes. Why? Well, because they're so small. There's a law in nature, and that is a very universal scientific law. If you want to detect something, observe something, the bigger, the better. So if your eyes are big, you can observe better than if your eyes are small. So a fly has very small eyes. If you look how they are made, you realize that you see the individual pixels of what they can see on their heads. They can't see very accurately. They can't see the specks of dust on a window when they fly against the window, so they bang their heads against the window. There are many things they can't see. So with our eyes, we can see other flies much better than they can. We can see the nerves in their wings. Probably they cannot see the nerves in their own wings. So, and that also holds for robots. Well, I was thinking of using tiny robots for instance, medical applications. You send the robot inside the human body and you do any kind of repair work that you think might be necessary, but they can't see very well. So you need a whole lot of them, and perhaps together the computer software can then make up the image that together they can produce. A very important piece of information is that what physicists have found out about matter holds not only on Earth, but also anywhere else in the universe. So all the stars, galaxies, and planets, whatever you have in the universe, is made out of the same matter of the kind that is being studied at CERN and elsewhere. And all experimental physicists who study matter at the same time study matter in the universe. We have recognized so many detailed properties of stars and galaxies in the universe that we know their atoms obey the same laws as our atoms. They are the same things. So whatever we say about our Earth also applies to outer space. And this is very important because, of course, we want to get there. Now, this is how science fiction authors, movie makers, imagine that we're going to travel in the universe, out to the rim of the galaxy, something like that, in fancy-looking spaceships. And the question is, will future space look anyway like this, or perhaps will the future spaceships look more like this? This is how NASA does it today. And what you notice here is that this space shuttle, when it goes to outer space, it produces an enormous lot of heat, energy. And so it's natural to criticize this way of going up, because it seems that this object, this rocket ship, is wasting enormous amounts of energy in going to outer space. And what people say also is these enormous boosters here, they contain all the fuel that the thing is going to use later. But in the meantime, they have to carry the fuel up in high into the atmosphere and beyond. Isn't that an enormous amount of waste? Why do you waste so much energy to put something up there? Well, I have a surprise for you, if you think that. This thing is fairly efficient with its energy. If you think of the payload that you really want to put in outer space, so in this case just a space shuttle, but sometimes only the things in the space shuttle, and you ask now, how much energy would be needed simply to lift it out of the gravitational potential of the Earth? How much energy is needed? Then you find that this thing is not very inefficient at all. Maybe an efficiency of 30 or 40% or so. But given the fact that there's no other way of doing it, that's quite an achievement, and it's not bad at all. So my claim is this is one of the best ways to get into outer space. And it will always be, as far as energy is concerned, you won't be able to do it much cheaper. If energy is the price you pay. Maybe you don't like the price you pay to the environment or to the complexity of building this machine. Maybe you want to have other ways to get out. But energy-wise, you can't do it much better. The reason is that although the booster carries all the liquids up, to use liquids there is very expensive, but you are pushing liquids actually down to Earth again. So actually, if you do the calculation, you find it's not so inefficient at all. You need to go out of the gravitational potential, and you need to develop a velocity of at least something like 7.5 kilometers per second. Just that basic fact cannot be changed, and so for that reason, this is one of the best ways to go up. Now what about what you read in science fiction, the black hole? A black hole is a given notion in theoretical physics. Many of us, also here at the Perimeter, have as a daily work the study of a black hole. And in science fiction, you read that black holes can perhaps be used. You go into the black hole, you make some sort of warp in space and time, and when you come out of it, you find yourself somewhere else in the universe, or perhaps even in a different universe, or something like that. Well, there are lots of things to say about this. A black hole mathematically, indeed, looks like a wormhole. It looks like the entrance of the underground, the metro, and it looks as if you can go underground out of space-time, and you can go back up, and then you're elsewhere in the universe. Mathematically, it looks like this. Unfortunately, if you think a bit more, you find that it doesn't work. It doesn't work at all for very fundamental reasons. So my argument is, I'm very sorry about all that black hole research, which you can't use them to get into outer space from here to there, or whatever. One of the main reasons is a black hole generates tremendous tidal forces. So if you go into a black hole, you discover that the thing is pulling at you. It's pulling your arms and your legs off your body. And it does that with great strength. And now I give you a little formula. Now this formula might possibly not show up well in the web, or maybe it does, I hope. This formula gives you the following thing. This is for physicists. So the others may close their eyes for a moment. Velocity of light, Newton's constant, mass of the black hole. This thing here is the radius of the black hole, and this is the speed of light, and so this is a frequency. It tells you something like a number of hertz. If you calculate this frequency for a black hole as heavy as the sun, which is enormous, we hope that such a black hole will never come close to us because it will completely disrupt the planetary system. For a black hole as heavy as the sun, this frequency is typically something like 100,000 per second, 100,000 hertz, 100 kilohertz. Now, the black hole is as follows. Imagine a washing machine that rotates 100,000 times per second. No ordinary washing machine can do that, but just imagine. Now, that's the kind of centrifugal force that you will feel if you try to fall into a black hole. So imagine test pilots or pilots of jet planes sometimes have to practice in a centrifuge. That centrifuge may go around perhaps once per second or so, really very tiny, perhaps several times per second, but never 100,000 times per second. If you go in a centrifuge 100,000 times per second, you are dead. Your body, the atoms of your body will fly in all directions. So what you would need is a black hole of 10,000 solar masses. Then that frequency is 10 per second. It's still extremely uncomfortable, but you won't be dead. Now, what's the problem there? Well, such heavy black holes do exist. Here you see a movie that has been made using observations of stars moving around near the center of our galaxy. This is the center of our galaxy, or rather, this is an object around which these stars seem to be moving. You saw that one? It went that way. This is a very, very strong center of gravity. And you see basically nothing coming out of that, no light. So that thing, you can calculate how massive it is. All these stars, they don't care about each other. They only care about this point. And you see how strongly this star is being attracted. This is a great distance that these stars are apart. Nevertheless, they seem to be attracted by this point by tremendous forces. If you calculate how big should that mass be to cause such an attraction, the answer is a few million solar masses. So that would be the black hole that we would like to use to transport us into another region of space-time. However, if you look in another kind of light, typically X-ray light, that same thing sits here, and here is all sorts of activities going on. In fact, this black hole is capturing other forms of matter. It's not totally black at all. It's emitting light because it's glowing up, because all the things falling in. If you throw in a little pebble like this, all its mass will be converted to energy, at least a sizable fraction of its mass will be turned to energy. That pebble will evaporate and emit enormous amounts of energy. And while you try to jump into the black hole, there are other pebbles also falling in. And if they hit you, you're dead again, because they hit you with forces that dwindle the Hiroshima bombs and things like that. So you'll be bombed to pieces, not by the black hole itself, but by anything else that happens to fall into the black hole. And this black hole is so heavy, attracting so much material, it's likely to be associated with an accretion disk of matter falling in, and that matter will kill you when you try to get into it. So there simply is no way to use a black hole for transportation. There's one other interesting alternative that has been considered seriously by science. Even NASA is thinking about this. It's called tethers. That is the use of cables to pull something into the stratosphere rather than to use rockets. This is the idea. You take a stationary orbit around the Earth, a geostationary orbit, where all the geostationary asteroids or satellites are sitting. And there you take an asteroid, a little bit beyond that, and you connect that asteroid with a cable to the Earth. So why shouldn't you do that? You just have a cable, and then you have an elevator connected to the cable, just climbs up, and you go in outer space with an elevator instead of with a rocket ship. And people seem to be thinking that this is energetically much cheaper than a rocket ship. I just explained to you that's not so. This costs as much energy as the Challenger or the space shuttles do when they try to get up into the stratosphere. So it is energetically expensive. But maybe you could connect another cable, letting something else down, and then you can use that energy. So unlike the rocket ships, this energy might be retrievable. So that could be an advantage. So they think seriously about the cable. But there is a problem, a scientific problem that's very essential for this. It does not make the cable impossible, just we can't make it today. And why is that? You need a cable that is very, very strong, of course, but also it has to be very, very light, because these are more than 40,000 kilometers, 30 or so thousand miles, and that's a very, very long stretch of cable. That cable will weigh so enormously heavy that it will succumb under its own weight. And now you can calculate what kind of cable would you need that is strong enough and light enough. Well, that is an indication of the quality of the cable. The quality of the cable would be its strength divided by its weight. Now, the strength is expressed in a notion called gigapascal, and you want to divide its strength by its weight per meter. And that turns out to be an expression that is kilogram meter per second. Per second square, that's the force, and then length weight per meter. So this is the combination you have to compute. You discover that the quantity is expressed in meters per second square. The kilogram drops out, because the kilogram is defined in the force and defined in the weight. So just meters per second square. That's a velocity square. So the quality of a cable is expressed in a velocity. If you calculate that velocity for steel, you get something exceeding a little bit the velocity of sound, 392 meters per second squared. That's the strength of a steel cable that you can make. Now, the strength that you need here is something comparable to the escape velocity of Earth. That's 11 kilometers per second. So this is not 11 kilometers per second. This is only 300 meters per second. So steel is not good enough. You shouldn't even try to make a cable out of steel. But here come the nanotubes. The nanotubes are enormously strong, much stronger than steel in this respect. And their quality will be something like 7 kilometers per second. Well, that is if you have a perfect nanotube. Well, will we ever be able to make perfect nanotubes? Will we be able to weave them in a cable Will that be totally safe? Will the cable not snap at some point? Well, that is something that we'll have for the future. But at least fundamental science says you can reach this. This would be good enough to make a cable that pulls you all the way off the Earth. What you'd have to do is make the cable a bit thicker where the strength, where the force is big, make it very thin where the force is tiny, and then you can reach all the way to outer space. This would do the job if you can make such a cable. So nanotubes could be the answer to this problem of getting into outer space. And so I enter to the topic of human colonization. And here I have all sorts of ideas that are somewhat strange, but you could first ask, what would be the reasons to go into outer space? And of course, the standard reason is our curiosity. We'd like to know what it's like out there. But then people will say, wait a minute, curiosity is not a good enough reason because we can send robots to outer space. In fact, that's already being done today. We send robots to outer space, and they seem to be working marvelously. Robots have robotic eyes. They can see everywhere in the spectrum. We can make instruments that make them see things in the infrared, ultraviolet, radio, you name it. The robots can see that. Humans cannot. So the robots can do much, much more than humans can do in outer space. So if it's only about curiosity, stay home and watch television rather than go into outer space. However, there's something else, and that is we simply want to go there. So shut up with your argument about curiosity. We just want to go there. It's our human nature that we want to expand. We don't want to stay on this lousy Earth. We want to get out into space and go to Mars or go to the moons of Jupiter or whatever, even go to the stars. We simply can't stay at home. And I think that's a much more honest way to describe a motivation rather than saying that it's only for curiosity. Not even for science. We can do science using robots. We don't have to send humans there for science. We don't have to send humans there for other arguments like exploitation of minerals and so on. All that could be done by robots. For that, humans are not needed. But humans are just needed because humans want to go there, period. So that would be the argument for colonization of space. Now, of course, if you use that as an argument, then you should say, well, that will only happen if it is affordable. And today, any space travel is tremendously expensive. So the question is, how can we make that affordable? Now, you can read a lot about this, of course, in the science fiction novels. And what do they say? Well, just read the novels of, say, 1960 or so, and then you read that already by the year 2000, everybody will be flying in a spaceship and so on. Our cars have no wheels anymore, things like this. And we have super intelligent robots surrounding us. All that didn't happen in 2000. So they were dead wrong. And there were other things that they absolutely did not foresee. What were those? Well, I think the role of the media. If ever somebody is going to set up a colony on the moon, the media will be there. There will be television shows all over the place. And they'll watch your every step on the moon or wherever you're going. And it will spread over the whole Earth. Everybody will enjoy that. So we are just one community. I think also science fiction authors underestimated the role of the mobile telephone and things like this. And I think now if you want to use this to make colonization of space affordable, well, we need fundraisers. And the fundraisers like to have their name on the screen. So we need the media also to help us raise funds to make colonization of space affordable. The internet. How many science fiction authors have predicted that? I think not many, only very few could foresee something like the internet and World Wide Web and things like this. That's, again, humanity has been united by the information revolution, I could call it, by a tremendous amount. That everybody would have a personal computer in his pocket, practically. That was unimaginable, even by the science fiction authors. So you can imagine how easy it is, how to get it dead wrong when you try to predict the future. I think now the internet is also extremely useful because the internet contains more information than anything else. And now you can look up practically everything you want very quickly. And this is also going to improve rapidly. So very soon, you can just ask the internet any question. Instead of Google, where you have to just punch in some words that you want to find, you can now ask real questions and the internet will answer. I think the internet will be one of the first information technological devices which will become truly internet. You can talk with the internet, it will talk back to you. I think that's going to happen fairly soon. And the remotely controlled robots, that's where the science fiction authors usually got it right. Thinking of robots which can do everything. But again, they'll be connected to the information center everywhere. So when we colonize space, we should make absolute maximum use of these new developments, which have not been foreseen by the science fiction people mostly, and which should perhaps make colonization of space more affordable. So having robots in space is tremendously advantageous. In fact, it's happening today. Not this crazy man-like thing, but here you see a robot which is running around on Mars right now and making lovely observations and scientific discoveries on the planet Mars today, two of them, the Opportunity and the Spirit, doing marvelous work. So sending robots to space really works and helps us understand foreign bodies surrounding us very beautifully. Here, another robot took a close-up picture of one of Jupiter's moons, Ganymedes, this is, and I think this thing looks very inviting. It started begging to us, please come and put up your house here and the community. And look how interesting our world is if you see it from really close. And another marvelous robot is now studying Saturn's rings. This thing is called Cassini, and it's been circling for several years now around Saturn and making beautiful observations, not only very detailed observations about the rings of Saturn, about which I have to say a little more later, but also many of its moons. So here you see some of the moons of Saturn. I don't know if I had all the names now, but it really made beautiful close-up pictures. And I think all these are begging, you know, come and have a look here and how nice we look. There's water is plentiful in these places. It's all frozen, but it's rather easy to heat it up. That's not really a problem. So you can get there and live there and whatever. You have a different life than on Earth, for sure. So yes, the question is the solar system. Here it is. All the major planets. The major planets are not the most interesting ones. What's much more interesting is their moons and perhaps their rings. I'll say something perhaps about the rings later. So these moons are very interesting, but the question is, can we go there? Well, one thing is known. You can go to the moon and it takes just 3 or 4 days or so and you can get there. Marvelous. And so the moon is a thing that the only foreign body in space that actually humans have been setting foot on. So the moon is something that is clearly there, but many other planets and asteroids can be traveled to. Mars will typically take 8 months to get there. The asteroid takes something like 1 year. And now I'm quoting the amount of time it requires to get there by means of more or less conventional ways. Maybe you can reduce these times a little bit, but it will always be the order of magnitude that a journey to these other places will take. And beyond, well, Uranus, Neptune, they all have interesting moons to live. And perhaps Pluto, well, that will take more. It depends very much on the efficiency of future propulsion methods, how fast you can get there. But it probably will take many years. Right now, there's a satellite on its way to Pluto. It will take 10 years or something like that. But maybe in the future, it can be done a bit faster. So let me now give my scenario about how humanity might be able to colonize the world. And I'm meaning not go there and then pick up some stones and go back and never go there back again. That's what happened to the moon. I find it very disappointing that when I thought that that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin were stepped on the moon, I thought, well, this is going to be the beginning of a new era. Now we will soon have houses on the moon and we soon have a whole community there. That didn't happen. They went there a few times, and then they came back again, and then the money was out, and the interest was disappeared, and that was the end of the story. That's not the kind of colonization which I would have in mind. So I'm thinking of a different scenario. We'll have to put a permanent colony on the moon. So that's what I like to dream about. I think it would be silly to think that you can bypass the moon and go directly to Mars. That seems to be what many people have in mind. They think the moon is ugly, uninteresting, has too low gravity, no atmosphere. What should we be doing there? But the moon is highly interesting. The fact that it is small and has no atmosphere is a bonus. It makes the moon much easier to get to than Mars. And don't remember, it takes only a few days to get there, whereas Mars takes several months at least. So it will be very important to try to conquer the moon. And there are also very fundamental advantages of the moon. Once you're on the moon, from there to Mars is going to be a lot easier than from the Earth to Mars. So the moon will be, if not an interesting place by itself to go there, it will be a stepping stone. There are lots of things to be done on the moon. You can try to colonize, you can explore things, you can also exploit things. There will probably be all sorts of minerals that will be interesting for Earth to get. And of course, you can do a lot of science on the moon. Indeed, enormous amount of science. Think of what the astronomers can do. The moon is enormously stable, and seismic activity is really minimal on the moon. So you can build large arrays of telescopes which are very stable. Now, what astronomers like to do is they like to put a number of telescopes at a few kilometers distance from each other, and then link the signals. Then they get the same signal that would have been found by one telescope of a kilometer in diameter. Remember what I said about eyes. The bigger the eyes, the more accurate you can look. Well, telescopes are the prime example of that. The bigger the telescope, the better it can look into outer space. So the largest telescopes people will be able to build on the moon. And not only that, you can do radio astronomy, in particular at the backside of the moon. The backside of the moon is the only place where you can do radio astronomy without getting nasty interference from 50 hertz or 60 hertz signals, or from mobile telephones or television channels or what have you. So I think the backside of the moon will be one place where mobile telephones will be forbidden, where television will be forbidden. The use of AC current will be forbidden because the astronomers want to use those channels to look into outer space, which is simply impossible today. And I read about a funny, remarkable thing. You can search for ancient rocks from Earth on the moon. Why would you want to do that? Well, rocks that fell billions of years ago on the moon will still be lying there, whereas rocks of billions of years ago on Earth all have been processed by dynamical processes on the Earth. They don't sit there anymore. You can't find them anymore. But you may be able to find those on the moon, and then you can investigate the very earliest forms of life on Earth. But you can investigate by looking at the moon. And then, of course, you can do many kinds of science which require low gravity, low temperatures. Inside some craters, the sun is never shining, so those are extremely cold. You can go for low temperature just there. Low pressure, of course, there's a high vacuum on the moon, so making vacuum is extremely easy. You can do all sorts of very interesting science there. Here is step one for colonization. So I take a rocket ship. The rocket ship goes a one-way trip to the moon. On board are passengers, not human passengers, because they want to go back, that's a nuisance, but robots. Quite a few of them, say a few dozen robots or so. Smaller versions of the robots that have been landing on the moon so far, but smarter ones. They're equipped with a camera. I call a webcam. I call those things cambots, just to say they're robots equipped with a camera. And we send a few dozen of those, and then the question is, what are we going to do with these cambots? The following thing. Now here, okay, this is what I describe in my book. So far, only the Dutch edition exists. If you can read Dutch, I advise you to read it. But the English version will come shortly. Playing with Planets, it's called. We should also send a power station, right? You want to have lots of electric power because these cambots will need that much power. And a very powerful communication channel with the Earth, because we want to control those robots from Earth. And now they are going to do work for us, and they're going to earn money for us. How do you do that? Well, here's my idea. They'll be leased to the internet public. You sit in your lazy chair at home. You have bought some special software and hardware and with some joysticks, and you see the image, and you imagine yourself riding on the moon in this Cambot. That will be very expensive, but this is the way to finance the whole thing. I just recently learned there is another way to finance it. It costs about more than $1 million to send a kilogram of matter from Earth to the moon. So someone imagined that maybe various people after their death wish their ashes to be thrown on the sprinkled on the moon. Well, if that's your wish, it can be done for a few thousand dollars, because you just only need a few grams to be sprinkled on the moon, and that will be relatively cheap. And that will be a source of income. Well, be it as it may, there are several other things you can think of to get income. So in short, this is just entertainment. This is not for science, not for industry, not for exploitation, not for military application, and so on, just for entertainment. Entertainment is, after all, where the real money is today. So maybe that's a way to do it. Leasing a Cambot will be expensive. Clients are all over the world, so many of them can afford to pay. It is fun. You can do sightseeing. You can do Cambot Quidditch, which is playing some sports with balls. Imagine what it would be like on the moon, where the gravity is only 1/6 of the Earth gravity. Think of a rally, all these sort of things. But of course, these things are vulnerable. If you handle them wrongly, they'll fall in the crater and they'll break, and you can't get them out. So you need to pay an enormous deposit or insurance. And the reason why it's difficult is that a signal to and from a Cambot will take 3 seconds to go there and come back. So whatever you do with your joystick here, the response will be seen only 3 seconds later. That makes it difficult, but not impossible. You need very smart software to handle that situation. You see a projection of what the result of your action will be, and then you get the real image 3 seconds later. So it should be possible. You might need a Cambot driving license, but people don't trust you. If you spoil the thing, if you don't know what the priority rules are on the moon, then maybe you cause accidents. But the most important thing is, it was very expensive, but maybe you can earn your money back. And that's because there's work for you to do. You want to build roads, you want to build new power stations, and you want to dig, I'll tell you why in a minute, and you want to search for water, and you want to search for building materials, and of course you want to learn. All those things, if you do all those things, you might be paid back. How, I don't know. Maybe you'll be paid back in real money, maybe you'll be paid back in forms of credits. When the first real humans come in the hotel, they'll pay back the money that you've earned. And then, of course, more important and more difficult work begins. You have to cultivate plants and animals. So there are chicken on the moon and fish and plants, and you try to raise them because you want to have a food industry there. And then, of course, construct the first real lunar hotel for real people. After this work is finished, the first human tourists are expected. And they, of course, pay lots of money, and that's how the whole project could be financed. Now, maybe the idea is silly. Maybe the idea is silly to involve the public in handling these Cambots. Maybe that will never happen. That's in nobody's minds today. So maybe that's not going to happen. But I just thought maybe you can this way get more payment and get the project really cheap. Also, it makes the project very publicly present. So everybody in the whole world will participate in the project. So that makes it much more interesting for people to continue. And then, after a amount of time, you'll have permanent immigrants. Not in the beginning, but later on, perhaps. And then you'll have a true first lunar colony. This is how I imagine one fancy, expensive lunar hotel will look like. This thing has parabolic walls and is rotating about twice per minute around its vertical axis. It rotates because if you stand here, you just feel lunar gravity. But you can just walk straight up like that. And here, you'll feel Earth gravity. So you walk in this hotel, you walk through a corridor. First, you're very light and a bit dizzy because you're on the moon. But then, after a while, you feel quite comfortable because here, the gravity is just like on Earth. So at these spots here, you feel Earth gravity. So if you want to relax for a while and you have enough of the moon, you have luxury rooms here. You have a site that goes around twice per minute. So it's a marvelous hotel. And maybe in the middle there's a swimming pool for weightless swimming or something like that. You can imagine all sorts of beautiful things. However, the first colonies will be underground, because this is very difficult to make from scratch, right? So the first colonies will be underground. You dig and make tunnels. That's probably the easiest way to make a fairly safe hotel, less fantastic as this one, but cheaper and more easy to make. So that's why I wanted them to dig first. But then they have to make glass to make things like this, where you have a glass wall so you can look at the outside, and also you can cultivate plants and fish and so. And I talk about ice, so not on the moon, but on the icy moons and planets further away from the in the solar system. Ice is plentiful, and there you can use ice as a building material. It's a marvelous building material. We've had the moon, we've colonized that, hopefully successfully. Then the question is about Mars. I think it is silly to try to go to Mars today, or even 10 years from now, because people will go to Mars and they will come back. They might go again and they'll come back, but they'll never establish a colony there. So why do all this? You can better send robots. But eventually, of course, you want to send a colony to Mars. Well, I think those people on the moon will have so much experience, they will know how to make a colony. And they'll use a smarter version of CAMBOTS, because the CAMBOTS, now the return signal is delayed by something like 20 to 40 minutes at Mars. So now it's going to be really difficult to control those CAMBOTS, unless, except when they are really intelligent. This is the mathematician John von Neumann, who have proved that robots might be able to reproduce themselves. That is a fancy idea, that maybe robots can be used to make other robots. And maybe they can be made intelligent as well. So really you can make robots to be some sort of artificial life form. And they can go to Mars without any difficulty and do the work much more autonomously. So if you send what I call a Neumann bot to Mars, you still might have to control it from home, but when it falls, it'll know how to get on its wheels by itself. It'll know how to find the electricity socket by itself. You don't have to tell them that. So they get smarter and smarter as information technology improves. All this is not forbidden by science. These are the things that I like very much. I call these things Neumann bots because they are so intelligent. Eventually they can reproduce themselves. They are super intelligent and do everything that humans might have been able to do. They can go way beyond the places that humans can visit. And now, Saturn's rings. I like to look at those very much when Cassini puts a close eye on them. They seem to be very quiet. It seems as if you can just land on them. And there's no gravity there, just rocks, lots and lots of building material. The total surface of these rings here is, I think, more than 100 times the surface of the Earth. So there's enormous amount of landscape here. And since there's no gravity, robots will have a very easy time dwelling around here. Perhaps not so much humans, although I can even imagine humans to live there. But the robots can. So these rings will be a marvelous place to cultivate robots of all sorts, including the Neumann robots, which should reproduce themselves. They can first try to do that on those rings. But they can go much further. They can go beyond Pluto, because it doesn't matter. You don't have to control them anymore. So if the delay time is many hours, like on Pluto, 6 hours or so, or no, I think even more on Pluto, so you can't control them from home anymore. They have to control themselves. And they can go much farther. In fact, they, after a certain number of thousands of years, they might even reach other stars. They go from dwarf planet to dwarf planet. You know, the planets, Pluto included, beyond the orbit of Neptune are called dwarf planets. And there must be quite a few of them. Had not yet been discovered today, but they will be in the near future. And we'll know lots of those dwarf planets. Those Neumann bots can go there. And maybe there are dwarf planets so far away that you reach really interstellar space and eventually you come closer to other stars. That will take many, many thousands of years, because velocities will never be so great. And this is something I have to say about velocities. In science fiction stories, spaceships can quickly reach the speeds of light and beyond. That, I think, is impossible for all sorts of reasons. my suspicion is that the only practical velocities that humans can ever reach would be something like 1,000 kilometers per second. Not today, not tomorrow, but maybe in the distant future, using nuclear energy and whatnot. But not much faster than that. And that would still mean that you would require many millions of years to reach the nearest star. So we'll simply, as humans, we'll never reach the nearest stars, because millions of years, you can't survive that. Also, it's extremely unrewarding to go there, and nobody will pay for you, because nobody will be interested in knowing what the world will be a million years from now, because you're all dead. So it doesn't work, and there's no reason for that. I think, therefore, humanity will eventually conquer the galaxy, but not us, but our Neumann bots. And they'll be intelligent enough to go to the rest of the galaxy, just rebuild themselves, reproduce themselves, and eventually cross from one star to the next, eventually go to the entire galaxy. Humans of flesh and blood will not do this. It simply will not be the trouble. And living organisms will be colonizing the other planets, other stars and so on, because the Neumann bots can take with them seeds and germs and perhaps also simply DNA information to build terrestrial-like life on other planets outside our solar system. I think that is, scientifically speaking, in principle possible. Now, the science that applies to us is the same science that applies universally in the universe. And I think that's a very important thing to remember. Science, the scientific restrictions that we suffer from, are also the scientific restrictions that aliens from other planets will suffer from. So what I say about humans also holds for aliens. And I just said that humans of flesh and blood will not be able to make the journey from one star to another star, because these are usually light years away from each other. That will hold for aliens as well. And not only now, but also a million years from now and a million years ago. So for that reason, I simply don't believe that aliens made of flesh and blood of whatever kind will be able to make such a trip. Quite to the contrary, their Neumann bots will be able to make the trip. So if ever we are being visited by alien civilizations, they will look more like robots than like humans or any living organism that we know of. They'll be very, very well adapted to a million years or so in outer space, and then survive that and try to use materials from where they arrive to make new Neumann bots. That's the kind of visits we should expect in principle from aliens. And so the Neumann bots might reach us, but it seems that they haven't done so yet. I think if they had been here, we would have known about it. There would be Neumann bots all over the moon, all over other icy planets, or rocky planets in our solar system. We've seen none of them anywhere. So my strong conviction is there are no such aliens which made such a journey. Then you can ask, why not? Was it wrong what I said? May well be. It may well be simply never possible for whatever intelligent form that we can create to cross the distance between stars. I find that somewhat difficult to believe if you think of the very distant future. A million years on a cosmological time scale is absolutely nothing. If humans can do this 100 million years from now, they may well imagine somewhere in the galaxy that 100 million years ago a civilization lived like us and was able to do this sort of trick. And they would have spread now by now over the entire galaxy, including us. It hasn't happened, and therefore I have a strong suspicion that actually there is no alien life in the rest of our galaxy. To hop from one galaxy to another is quite something else. That will cost indeed billions of years, and it may be that the universe is simply not old enough for such a thing to have happened yet. So maybe there's intelligent life forms that have spread all around other galaxies, but they have been unable to reach us because the distance between galaxies is simply too big. That may well be. Are Neumann bots dangerous? This is a very important question. You read a lot about in science fiction. Imagine that robots become intelligent. Might they not become a threat for humans? That's an interesting question, but I think there's a good answer to it. Not if you're sufficiently careful and take the right measures. You can read about the behavior of organisms controlled by genes in the books by Richard Dawkins. he describes how come that organisms can be aggressive and can wish to fight and want to remove you from the system and so on. It's all in their genes. How come? It's because the way they multiply themselves and the way they pass on genetic information from one individual to the next. That we should not never allow to happen with our Neumann bots. So what we should do is make our Neumann bots the way that Dawkins describes ants. An ant is an animal that comes in a whole family of ants, and they all are directly created by a single queen. So they all have genetically identical material in them, and therefore they are all loaded with the same information. And that information is very important, that information. The ants are programmed such that they don't harm each other. So in a heap of thousands or millions of ants, the ants never fight each other. They are constructive. And so our Neumann bots should look like ants. And we should be sure that the queen of these Neumann bots is just a great big computer which stays on Earth. So on Earth, we dictate the genetic buildup of a Neumann bot, and we never allow them themselves to do experiments on genetic engineering. Then we would be in danger. So that is simply not in their program, and then it won't happen. So that is a restriction. That might be a restriction of having Neumann bots go too far to outer space, because we won't allow them to change their genetic composition. So this is some aspect for the future to think about. Well, in this lecture, I hope that I've given you some ideas about what science can do, but more importantly, also limitations. It's unlikely that humans will go further into space than the limits of our own solar system, which would be marvelous if we could be able to do that. It would be marvelous if we could send robots or other machines to more distant regions in the universe to spy for us, to look what it's like from close. But and there are marvelous, unimaginable applications of science in the aspect of information technology, in particular of the computers of the big future. I think we're only right now at the beginning of these developments. There's much, much more to come. So that's where life can become extremely interesting for the future generations. I'm just imagining, say, the future president of the United States to be a robot or an intelligent computer. That would be an enormous advantage. It hasn't happened yet, so thank you very much.
What will happen to modern physics if the Higgs boson is not found at CERN? What are the implications?
Okay, this is indeed somewhat beside the topic of this lecture. It's about the physics of the big accelerators, in particular this one and this one. So one of the prime missions of these machines is get hold of this Higgs finally. We're waiting for it so long. So don't miss it this time. And I think there's a high probability that they will find the Higgs. So the odds are now very much in our favor. Unlike the previous machines, where people were optimistic, but the hopes were not very high. Now we say it's practically certain that this thing will find the Higgs. But as you rightly say, there's a possibility that they will not be able to find it. There could be all sorts of reasons for that. One is the Higgs is hiding. The particle could have such properties that it's difficult to detect. It's quite possible. People have written many papers on how a Higgs, what kind of Higgs could be there, which are very difficult to detect. Then we say, okay, we have to wait longer. The machine has to be switched on for a longer amount of time, and eventually we'll find it. Or it could be that there's not one Higgs, but a whole load of them, different kind of Higgses, each together doing the job of one Higgs, but each having a different mass. If this happens, then each of them separately will be very difficult to detect, and maybe you don't see anything at all. And finally, there could be no Higgs at all in the mass range where we expect it. That is unlikely because it does not agree with all our theoretical findings that we did find today. In fact, you could argue in a way that 3/4 of the Higgs is hiding in the particles we already see. And these particles have all the properties of 3/4 of the Higgs degree of freedom. The thing we call Higgs is the one remaining quarter of that particle, which seems to be hiding itself so well. We understand why it has not yet been detected. That's not the real problem. But our difficulty is to find it. If it is not found, then indeed theories will have to be revised rather significantly. We would be overjoyed to do that. So if the Higgs is not found, theoreticians will still have a good time. But experimentalists will feel very sorry because there's other Nobel Prize which they're not going to get for not finding the Higgs.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.